Charlotte Sibtain and Cole Morton uncover the stories behind lost wedding photographs. This week, the story of a young woman and a soldier in the 1960s. A scrapbook shows the growing romance and the excitement before the planned wedding. But there's no wedding album. The wedding detectives investigate at 8 p.m. And later on tonight, we'll be heading into the undergrowth.
On BBC Radio 4.
The two of us walking around here in the dark.
Jarvis Cocker invites you out for a new series of nocturnal adventures.
There's no one else here, so whatever we get up to out here is our own business.
Explore a world of nighttime forest walks, full moons and bats.
Do you know that the French word for bat is chauve-souris, and that means bald mouse?
Wireless Nights, Monday nights at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Thank you very much for your company.
This is BBC Radio 4.
The Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Southampton Solent University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, the largest imaginary edifice in the world, with more wings than a swarm of locusts. But the real buzz around here is entirely due to our irrefutably corporeal 16th curator, Holly Walsh.
Hello, John.
Hello, Holly. Well, it's your last day at the museum, sadly, so I hope everyone's been treating you well.
Oh, my God, it's been I'm so sad to leave, Professor, but everyone's been so nice. Some of the staff gave me a liquid lunch.
Oh, you've been down the pub, have you?
No, they put my sandwiches in a blender.
Ah.
But it's the thought that counts.
Yeah.
That's what they told me.
Well, quite right. Well, now, if there was one donation you could take with you as a keepsake of your time here, which would it be?
Oof, difficult. I've got my eye on Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights ever since it was donated. I think it would look amazing on my bathroom wall. Certainly beats looking at an iPhone when you're having a poo.
Right. Let's meet today's eminent steering committee. Computer programmer and comedian Deliso Chaponda, firefighter and neuroscientist Dr. Sabrina Cohen-Hatton, and anaesthetist and space engineer Dr. Kevin Fong. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
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 Now, Deliso, you're a Malawian who was born in Zambia, educated in Canada, and grew up in Thailand, Kenya, Switzerland, and Australia. How can you tell when you're on holiday?
I think traveling around a lot means you actually lose all allegiance to nations at all. So I'm not attached to anywhere. I'm attached to people. So my holidays is when I stop seeing people who frustrate me and start seeing people who delight me.
Oh, that's wonderful. Sabrina, firefighting's pretty serious business, but is there humour in firefighting?
I hope so. I think it would be really boring if there wasn't a chance for humour.
There is something bizarrely comical, actually, about being on scene. I mean, so I've worked with your fire service. I fly with their ambulance, Kent, Surrey, Sussex, Sabrina. There is a glimpse of a moment where you're standing there with the police and the fire service and the ambulance crews, and you're there in your helicopter gear, and it sort of feels like you're all just been in the dressing up box for too long, and like some badly built set out of Playmobil.
Deliso, you're the writer and host of Radio 4's 2019 Rose d'Or nominated Citizen of Nowhere. You were the first comedian to reach the finals of Britain's Got Talent in 2017, and you're currently on tour with your brilliantly titled show, Apocalypse Not Now. Now, Deliso, firefighting, emergency surgery, how dangerous is it making people laugh?
In the UK, not very dangerous at all. As much as comedians will try and pretend like they live a dangerous rock and roll life, UK, you can get away with anything. However, I have got in trouble in other countries. The most crazy one was in Malawi, where I made fun of the Malawi government and I had the censorship board threatening me. My father, who was a politician, was yelled at. And it was a whole big scandal, which culminated in me having to bribe some people in order to not get arrested.
You were studying computer programming originally, weren't you?
I wanted to be a writer. My family looked at my grades in math and physics and said, "You've actually got a future here. What are you doing?" And I was pressured to do computer programming. But then they made the mistake of paying for me to go to university in Canada where there's the Just for Last Festival. So I was tempted into comedy right there.
You mentioned earlier that you wanted to be a writer when you were young.
Yes.
And now you are one.
Now I am one. I am one. And so initially, I was going to write big, fat, pretentious, deep explorations of the human condition. I was like, I'm going to be the African Dostoevsky or something. And then time and just what you end up being good at is not necessarily what you want to be good at. And I just gradually discovered I was funny. And so humor took over the creative part of me. But in the last year and a half, because I couldn't perform for live crowds, I went back into the writing and I wrote a novel. And it was like speaking to me at 20 and doing what 20-year-old me wanted me to do for my whole life.
And your next book is The Page Divers, right?
Yes, The Page Divers, hoping it will come out before end of next year. It's a young adult about a child who discovers they can pull things out of books. So sort of like Ready Player One or something, but with novels.
That's such a good idea.
But because of copyright, all the books I refer to are very old. So it's a little odd that this little 12-year-old's reading 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea as opposed to Harry Potter. But it's just easier.
Well, thank you, Delisa. That was genuinely interesting. I mean, even your name is interesting. For example, here's an interesting thing. My name, John Lloyd, has only one possible anagram in English. Okay? Guess how many anagrams your name, Delisa Chaponda, has?
Two.
Okay, I'll tell you how many it is. It's 123,488 possible anagrams of Delisa Chaponda.
What?
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Is that using all the letters?
All the letters, every single letter. Here's some. A chaplain's dodo. A last candid poo.
Oh, wonderful.
Ah, Disco Poland.
That's, you know what? You have just co-written my next show.
Well, welcome to the museum, Delisa.
Thank you so much.
Coming to you now, Sabrina, you joined the fire service at 18 years old, became a station commander at 25, and are now chief officer of the West Sussex Fire Service. You also have a PhD in behavioural neuroscience, are an honorary research fellow at the University of Cardiff, and your book, The Heat of the Moment, looks at decision-making under pressure. Now, I'm fascinated to know, what led you to become a firefighter in the first place?
It's a really good question, actually. I didn't grow up thinking, I want to be a firefighter and I want to ride on fire engines. I actually had a bit of a different upbringing, and I ended up experiencing homelessness for on and off the best part of 2 years when I was a teenager. I first started sleeping rough when I was 15, not long before I was 16, and had a really difficult couple of years.
Wow.
And I actually sold The Big Issue to try to get out of the situation that I was in. So selling The Big Issue for me was incredible, because you are actually a bit of a micro entrepreneur. You buy a magazine for a certain amount of money and you sell it on for a bit more. It gave me a sense of self-confidence. It gave me some structure and it gave me an ability to earn. And eventually, after a few failed attempts at getting secure accommodation, I was able to get somewhere to live. When that became a reality, I started to think about what else might be possible. And the reason I started to think about the fire service is because it is such a privilege. You are literally trusted by people to know what to do when nobody else does, when they think there's no one that can come to help. And I could relate to that, because it felt like I'd spent the best part of 2 years wanting someone to come and help, and there was no one there. So I guess in a funny kind of way, I wanted to rescue other people in a way that no one was able to rescue me. And I started as a retained firefighter and then applied for a full-time position. But when I applied for a full-time job, it was so competitive that there were 9,000 applicants for about 12 jobs.
And how many of those were women?
Well, when I actually joined, I was woman number 7 in a workforce of 1,700 men.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact they called you woman number 7 is incredibly sexist in itself.
Not only are you a firefighter and a senior one at that, but in your spare time, you went and took a degree in psychology and a PhD in neuroscience. I mean, What? I mean, how do you...
When do you sleep?
I thought firefighters just played table tennis between shifts.
That's where you're wrong. We are not the stereotype. No, it actually happened after I had probably one of the most career-defining incidents that I'd ever experienced. It was when I was a firefighter. My husband, before we were married, we were also firefighters on neighbouring stations. And I was called to an incident where another firefighter had been quite seriously burned. And there was a 1 in 4 chance it was him. And I was torn between that role of a responder and all of the accountability and the responsibility that goes with that, and also the role of a loved one and all of the kind of fears and anxieties and those human aspects that go with that too. Anyway, fortunately for us, it wasn't him, but it was our colleague. And I felt so torn after this because I felt like by not wanting it to be him so much, I'd wished it on someone else. And that was something that I really struggled with. And it was after that I thought, well, maybe there's something that we can do to help people to stop it happening again. And initially I thought if we can get a better burns pack, we'd be better prepared. But what I found is that the majority of the time, 80% of the time, actually, injuries across all industries, including fire, happen as a result of human error. So I figured, actually, if we could understand human error better, maybe there's stuff that we could do to reduce human error. And that's when I started to do initially the degree all the way up to a PhD. And that was really tricky because I was working full time as a firefighter at the same time. So I'd go into the lab at 5:30 in the morning. I'd run my experiments and then I'd go and I'd pull a full shift in the fire service. And then I'd go home and I'd put my newborn baby to bed because that was great timing, wasn't it? And then I would go back in the lab for the night shift. But it was tough. But
worth it.
But
yeah.
In fact, I wrote a book about how we make decisions under pressure. And I wanted to take everything that we've learned from how we make decisions at fires and incidents, and also everything that we'd learned from the last 10 years worth of research, and try to apply it to everyday life. Because I figure sometimes if we can understand ourselves better and we can recognise how we're making a decision and how we're thinking, then it can only make us stronger and better in the future. Because decision making is a skill. It's a skill that needs to be practiced.
Well, thank you, Sabrina. You're clearly the person that we all need in a crisis. But for now, please accept our gratitude and this bucket of sand, just in case. So, over to you, Kevin. You're an anaesthesia consultant, as well as a flying doctor with the Air Ambulance, and are currently seconded to NHS England's Resilience and Response COVID team. You have degrees in astrophysics and medicine from University College London, a degree in astronautics and space engineering from Cranfield University, and you've completed space medical training at both the Johnson and Kennedy Space Centres. So, space and medicine. Would an air ambulance work in space?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because one of the things that I was very lucky to work on when I was working in Houston, I lived and worked in Houston on and off for about 10 years. And one of the things I worked on was this thing called the X-38 Assured Crew Return Vehicle that was basically a space ambulance. So when they were building the space station, they realized that they were going to get to a point when they weren't going to have enough space to get everyone off in the same vehicle if there was an emergency. And so they start designing this absurd, crazy-looking vehicle. And the idea was that if you had an emergency, if the thing was on fire, if you'd suddenly had a decompression, if someone was sick, you could all load into that, pull the handle, and then it would fly off into the atmosphere. You could steer it all the way home, and then it would deploy a parachute. It was fantastic to work on, a proper sci-fi-looking vehicle.
That run out of money, but we've got Jeff Bezos going up. Yeah. This was a better use of the money.
Do they always send a medic up in any space trip that they do?
There are many doctors in the astronaut corps, but they tend not to send a doctor up onto the space station because you're kind of a skills redundancy. There's nothing for you to do most of the time.
So they've got to self-medicate.
So they design the space station so that it's really, really hard for you to get ill or hurt yourself. They select people that are massively unlikely to get ill. They're the fittest people you'll ever see. You can't fall down the stairs. You're not going to get run over. You can't electrocute yourself up there. So actually, you're reasonably safe.
I read somewhere that you can't do CPR in zero gravity. Is that right?
Well, you can, but it's very, very difficult because almost anything that you want to do as a doctor on Earth, you can't do in space, or at least you have to rethink it. And so if someone has a cardiac arrest and you go and do a chest compression, Newton's laws of physics tell you that they're going to go one way, you're going to go the other, and no one's going to get very better. But there's a great story about this. When I was out in Houston, my flatmate was a flight surgeon, and he was showing the Russians around about all this kit that they had to do cardiac massage, and you know, this defibrillator that they'd built that could work in space. And they said, you know, we spent millions and millions of dollars building all of this kit. And look, Yuri, it all works. And this Russian just looked at him really quizzically and went, Steve, in Russia, we only send healthy astronauts into space.
Well, now, Kevin, your medical specialism is anesthetics. Is it true that there's still some mystery surrounding how they actually work?
So that is true. And it's true of the anesthetic agents that we give you to breathe in. So when you have an anesthetic in most hospitals, in this country at least, we tend to give you an anesthetic agent that we inject into your arm, into your veins, and that very quickly gets you off to sleep. But then after that, we replace it with the agents that you breathe in, and that keeps you asleep. Now, those ones, the effect that they have on your brain is not fully understood. Now, that said, anesthesia is ridiculously safe. I mean, if you're a fit, healthy person, if you're having an anesthetic, your risks of coming a cropper are 1 in 200,000 or that sort of number. The thing is safe. I mean, it does feel a little bit like magic every time we do it.
I love this fact that William Morton, who's known as the father of anesthesia, first experimented on himself, but he kept falling asleep before he could describe the results.
Wonderful.
Well, now, we need to open the museum for donations one last time this series. Holly, do you have a fanfare prepared for us?
Oh, yeah. I sure do, Professor. And what could be more special than the full pomp and ceremony of a military march?
Splendid.
So, please allow me to declare the museum open for donations, accompanied by the massed bands of the SAS. Yeah, I should point out that they were on a secret mission behind enemy lines when that was recorded. But, you know, still very grateful for their time. Cheers, lads. So, Deliso,
yes.
What would you like to donate to the museum?
I would like to donate a church of laughter.
I like it.
Because I feel that laughter is healing, it's transcendent. I see it all the time, and I think actually the entire God is love thing was a misprint. It's actually God is laughter. And so I think the Church of Laughter would be things like, instead of sermons, you get one-liners. Instead of pews, they're whoopee cushions. The stained glass windows have images of clowns. When you enter, you slip on banana peels. The entire room is just all about laughter. And, you know, people who have made us laugh, who have beloved and gone, they are the saints who are all around. And that's what I want to donate. All laughter is wonderful. And going to the Church of Laughter, you just go in and you just laugh. And it's a spiritual experience. And then you leave. And this is also, it saved my life, really, actually. I was a miserable, depressed person. And then I found comedy, the way one finds God. And it changed my life and saved me. So I'm very jolly now, but you are seeing me 20 years after making this my life and going from somebody who felt unaccepted and unappreciated to a profession where literally 100 people give you appreciation every night and make you feel validated. And I had a character I wished I was like, who I became on stage and then now have become in my life. So I oddly have this kind of religious way of looking at humor. And so, Church of Laughter.
Do you go around knocking on people's doors, just telling them jokes when they open on a Sunday morning, just to
that
get them involved?
That would be so much more welcome, wouldn't it? That would be so much more welcome.
It's a very good idea. We've got some great signs spotted outside American churches. Adam and Eve, the first people not to read the Apple terms and conditions. That's a pretty good line. And then, whoever is praying for rain can stop now. And this is very dark. Honk if you love Jesus. Text while driving if you want to meet him.
Oh, very good. Very, very good.
The good public health information there.
Yeah. Well, Deliso, listen, we devoutly welcome the Church of Laughter into the Museum of Curiosity. Seriously.
So, Sabrina, what exhibit would you like to donate to the museum?
Well, I would like to offer the museum a pack of Shulowick Squintly dogs.
What is that? What are they?
I often get asked this question. So a Shulowick Squintly dog, or otherwise known as a Sholo or a Mexican hairless dog, is a breed of dog that were originally kept by the ancient Aztecs and the Mayans, believe it or not. They are one of a very few true primitive dogs that you can still get today. I have two of them. I absolutely adore them. But it's interesting, there's some really beautiful mythology that sits behind these. And they were believed to have been made from one of the ribs of Xolotl, who was the god of the underworld. And people believed that if you were good to these dogs in this life, then they would essentially guide you through the afterlife after you died. And they were very often buried with their owners. And they also thought that they had these kind of mystical healing properties. Because they're completely hairless, they feel warmer to the touch than a normal dog with lots of fur. They're not actually hotter, but they just feel it. So people used to go to bed with these dogs with all these aches and pains, and they'd wake up and they'd miraculously not be achy anymore, a bit like going to sleep with a hot water bottle. So they thought that these dogs were magic to boot. But they're incredible. They have never been selectively bred, so it's a little bit like trying to train a dingo. They take a lot of work, but they are incredibly loyal, incredibly intelligent, and very brave. And actually, there's a really interesting fact. The same genetic mutation that causes their hairlessness also means they don't have full dentation. So one of my dogs doesn't have any canines. He could literally gum an attacker to death.
Sounds like my snogging style.
I've always been a big fan of dogs, but traditionally I'd always had rescue dogs. I mean, even when I was experiencing homelessness, I was a stray girl and I found a stray dog and it worked really well. And he was, you know, an amazing companion. But when I met Mike, my husband, he is horrifically allergic to dogs. And fortunately for him, I was between dogs at the time that we met. And it took me ages to find a dog that he could tolerate. And even the so-called hypoallergenic breeds, although they don't shed, they're still producing a lot of dander, which they keep in their fur. And so he couldn't tolerate them. And in the end, I tried this breed. And because the dander comes off in such small quantities, he could tolerate them. And it turns out that a rare breed was a lot cheaper than a divorce, because that's where it was going to go.
Kevin, are you an animal person? Do you have dogs?
I do not. I'm fighting a rear guard action to prevent our family from getting a dog. There's a big campaign on at the moment. I've told them I'm really allergic.
So how many in the pack that you're donating?
Well, I would suggest at least 25.
Oh, just whoa. Basically. Goodness.
Yeah, well, they're so amazing that I feel like everyone that comes into the museum would need to be guided around the museum by one of these dogs. They're used to guiding in the afterlife.
That's great. Well, thank you, Sabrina, for introducing us to these hairless yet peerless animals, all 25 of them. And listen, I'm so glad it's helped your marriage. The hair of the dog has certainly helped mine, I must say.
Kevin, what would you like to put in the museum?
So I want to put something very specific in. I want to put in a sunrise after a night shift, and not just for the way it looks, but for the way it feels. So that's what I want. I want that sunrise after a night shift. And I want that because, you know, night shift is a particular thing. No one likes doing them. Everything's a little bit more dangerous, a little bit more scary at night. Everything's a bit harder. And I've often found myself, you know, out there just trying to get through that 12 hours, just trying to get through to the end. And so the sunrise is that sign that it's nearly over. And one of the things I remember most about flying with Air Ambulance Kent, Surrey, Sussex, flying with that charity, is some nights we find ourselves lifting out of the easternmost part of the region, so out of East Kent. And you come in and you track along the Thames estuary and you can be in real trouble. And that's a long flight. It's about half an hour's flight in. So for us even, it's a long time. And just as you think you're in real trouble, the sun's coming up over the city, and it's such a hopeful moment. I was reading about this recently, and that thing that people say about the night is always darkest before the dawn, I used to think that's just a stupid thing that people said. It is actually true, at least it's true when the full moon is up, because the moon sets just before the sun rises, so it is dark at that moment, and it is that moment of, you know, primal fear. And so, you know, that sunrise on those nights means even more. But the thing that made me really think about it was actually what we have all been through, all of us have been through, you know, COVID last winter. But the teams that we worked with in the hospitals, and I worked night shifts in my hospital, University College London Hospital, and the nights are awful. I can't begin to describe them to you. And our intensive care had expanded from the floor it was up onto two or three other floors. And you would go round and it would feel desperate and hopeless. And one night in January, and it was that weekend that it really snowed in London. One night I came back down onto the main intensive care unit and something was going on and all the nurses were crowding the windows. And what it was the sun was coming up and there was that big blanket of snow cloud. And so as the sun came up, the sky looked like it was on fire, and the nurses were all up there with their camera phones taking a photo of this dawn breaking over this really, really dark and horrible night. And, you know, it was that reminder, it was that ideal of hope, that reminder that the sun always comes back no matter how dark the night is. And you know, it is that feeling, it is that spectacle that I'd love to put in to the museum, and not just for me, but for all the people that I've worked with. You know, I'm proud of my teams. I'm always proud of the teams I work with, but I have never, ever been prouder of them than I have been this past few months.
That's so terribly moving, Kevin, and it just brings, you know, because those, you know, I've got a couple of friends who are doctors who had it reported, but I mean, it's all very well clapping the NHS, but I mean, what you guys have done is unbelievable. And the trauma that individual doctors and nurses have had to suffer, it must be nuts. It beggars belief that you had to do that.
They have been incredible. They are the answer to all of this. They are the thing that were the hope in moments that were, you know, some of the darkest moments that we've ever seen as a profession. So, you know, the sunrise after night shift for them, I think.
I love that, Kevin. Thank you for a really beautiful donation. The sunrise after a night shift that we will preserve forever in the museum. A sunrise, in fact, on which the sun will never set. So there we have it. The museum's collection now includes a surgical sunrise, a church full of chuckles, and a security team of shallows. I'd like to thank Deliso, Sabrina, and Kevin, and I leave you with this wise life advice from Ricky Gervais. Be the person your dog thinks you are. That's all from the museum this time. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Holly Walsh. The donors were Deliso Chaponda, Dr. Sabrina Cohen-Hatton, and Dr. Kevin Fong. The